VanWee Financial is a registered investment advisor. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and or tax professional before implementing any strategy discussed herein. It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the VanWee Financial Hour. I'm Steve VanWee.
And I'm Adam VanWee.
And we are here, as always, live and in color, this being the last Saturday in August, the last any day in August, actually. And we're all watching the storm with a great deal of anticipation slash apprehension, and probably will be for several days yet. The forecasters right now are giving us pretty good news on a daily basis. It seems to be curving out to sea. We hope it keeps up. It's a wonderful demonstration, as you look at it on the TV screens, of the difference between a forecast and a prediction.
Oh, I was going to say a demonstration of complete incompetence at your job.
Oh, that's... You can be two things at once.
Okay.
If you're clever.
Yeah.
Yeah. A forecast is called, in this case, the cone of uncertainty. It means it'll be somewhere between there and there. A prediction is that line they draw up the middle and say, that's probably what's going to happen. So a forecast encompasses 100% of probabilities, and a prediction is pick one. Your forecast can be very good. Your prediction can be off by a long ways, as shown by the ever-increasing cone of uncertainty.
Yeah, which keeps shifting dramatically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyways, keep an eye on it. Be safe. Mm-hmm. And we hope it turns out to sea and leaves us all alone.
Well, you know, but we had decades and decades of prosperity, I guess, when things just kind of left us alone. And it became sort of axiomatic that Jacksonville's geographic position is such that we're isolated and immune from these things. For the last 4 years or so have proven just how ridiculous that assumption is, and that we all have to be aware. But there is another interesting fact that is geographical. Jacksonville is west of Orlando. And that's something that if you tell people, you can win some money from them. But we are geographically west of Orlando. We are really tucked back in our little sheltered cove here. And I'm absolutely convinced that it does have some positive effects. It's just not a preventative.
No, it's not a guarantee by any stretch.
Yeah, so don't do any dumb things. And for those of you playing the home game, it's time to shelter in place and hunker down. And now you have your first two drinks of the day taken care of.
That one's for free.
A few people know, like Alan, know exactly what I'm talking about. Oh, let's talk about good things now. Geo's a nice week in the market, wasn't it?
Yeah, August.
It seemed weird, but it was good.
August has a reputation for being volatile, and this August did not disappoint. It was shaping up to be a really terrible month, and then this week happened, and it turned out to just be a kind of bad month.
Want to know something really interesting?
What's that?
If you eliminate August 14th, the month broke even almost to the 99.98% level.
Okay.
We had one day that tipped the scales negative.
Yeah, we almost made it up a little bit more because Friday started off really good. But then I think traders got a little scared headed into the long weekend. There's a lot of stuff going on.
Storm things.
Yeah, storm, China, Hong Kong, Trump. With Twitter, you just don't know what's going to happen, and I don't blame them for it was a mild sell-off. Actually, the Dow ended up, but
as did the S&P. Only the Nasdaq lost a few points.
Yeah, and it was pretty minimal.
And you know, I hate to even talk like this when there's a storm out there, but storms are good for the economics of the country because the rebuilding effort is a whole bunch of money being spent, and the consumer has a major impact as things are put back together. That said, I hope we avoid it completely.
Yeah, so for the week, all three indexes were almost 3% higher than they were at the beginning of the week. So much of that was rallying on a positive momentum with the talks with China. It was kind of weird because Trump came out first early in the week and said that they wanted to, China had called and they wanted to do a deal. Well, China, of course, immediately denied that. But then later in the week, they kind of backed off of that and said, yeah, maybe we will do that, and so that that fueled a little bit more of the positive news.
Did too. Did not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
bunch of children politics. Playing their games at the very highest level, because saving face is as important or more so than getting the job done.
Yeah, I mean, and that I think that's true on both sides of this one.
Too.
So, let's see, the Dow was the biggest winner, actually adding on 3%. Well, the S&P wasn't too far behind at 2.8%, and the NASDAQ added about 2.7%. So for the month, the Dow actually held up the best, losing just around 1.7%, the S&P at 1.8%, and the typically more volatile NASDAQ lost about 2.6%. For the quarter, all three indexes are down by around 0.5%, but that's really not that bad considering the choppiness that we've seen in the markets lately. I would have guessed it was a little bit worse than that.
And you tell me any day you want to, and we'll just stop the year and I'll take those gains and be happy all the way to January.
Yep.
How's that?
Dow up 13, S&P up 16.7, and the NASDAQ up 20 for the year. So I would take that right now.
Yeah, and the indicators look good too. The historical trends at a time like this. It doesn't mean you're going to happen in September, though, because September, everybody knows what September can bring, but nobody knows what it will bring.
Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest drags on the equity markets in August was energy. The energy sector lost over 8% in the month, which is, in my opinion, just ridiculous. It's already been beaten up, and it dropped that much further. Well, utilities gained 5% in the month, which I find equally ridiculous.
Well, not so bad if they were reasonably priced before, but they're too high.
They're already high, and energy is already super low if you look at price-to-earnings ratios. And so just piling it on, I mean, one looks to me like a bargain. The other one looks like I wouldn't touch it
no matter what. Trading by emotion,
mm-hmm.
and that's all it is. What are the two sectors that are up, the biggest two?
What do you mean, year-to-date?
No, just recently. This week, this month.
I didn't look at that. Financials were the second biggest drag, dropping almost 5%.
The two that are up over 10% for the month are 20-year plus treasuries.
Oh, I was thinking sectors of the S&P. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 20-year treasuries
and silver.
Yeah.
Now, what are those? Those are emotional moves. They're defensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows you that this market's not being driven right now by pure economics.
No, definitely not. So it wasn't just the U.S. that had a bad month. The international markets were pretty bad as well. Hong Kong and Brazil both dropped around 8%. Hong Kong's decline, pretty easy to understand, the civil unrest.
Mm-hmm.
Brazil, a little bit puzzling, I guess. I mean,
volatility, that's the only reason.
Yeah, they've had a pretty good year so far. So,
well, Bolsonaro is a pro-business guy. And, of course, that means he's getting a lot of backlash.
Yeah.
But he's not going to relent.
Oh, the wildfires.
And the Amazon.
Yeah.
You know, it's on fire.
Exactly.
And it's not on fire because of global warming. A bunch of farmers who want to farm the land.
Yeah. Anyways, one of the positive foreign markets this month was Mexico, which rallied almost 7% this week to close slightly positive in August, which was a big change.
Okay, I'll explain that if I ever figure it out.
Yeah, I can't. I have nothing.
You want to give the trivia question before the break?
Sure. We were talking about saving money recently, and one of the ways that people can save money is on gym memberships that go unused. What we'd like to know is, according to USA Today, what percentage of gym memberships go unused every year?
I'm going to guess it's above 5%.
I will narrow the bands and say it's above 5%.
Okay. Under 100 and above 5.
Well, I saw one report that put it at 80%, and I will say that is too high.
Okay. So, you're nice. Made a nice little bracket there, 5 to 80. All right. When we come back, we got a lot more to wrap up on the market, and then I want to talk about some fun things. So don't go anywhere. We will be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we have our trivia question out there, brought to you, as always, by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 636-7888, and Adam will remind you what that question is.
Yeah, what percentage of gym memberships go unused every year? And I will tell you that there are about 62 million people in the United States that pay for gym memberships every month.
Wow.
And that's rising. Almost every year it rises a little bit. But the percentage of them that go unused stays about the same.
Hmm. And we'll take that percentage plus or minus 2. We've already told you it's more than 5 and less than 80. So the lines are open, 904-222-TALK. It's 222-8255. Okay, a few little anecdotes about the market. You want to wrap up some stuff here?
Yeah, certainly. So speaking of treasuries, we were talking about those a little bit earlier because they really rallied during the month of August. The latest round of buying in treasuries has resulted in half of the stocks in the S&P 500 yielding more than the 30-year treasury. Now, if you look at the 5-year treasury, that number goes up to 2/3 of all S&P stocks that yield more. So what's a better deal? A company that has growth potential and is on solid financial ground and pays you to own a fractional share of it, or a note issued by the U.S. government that runs a deficit every month and basically an IOU that pays you around 1%. I know what I would choose, but that's just me.
Everybody's an individual, right?
Yep. And the economic data this month did what it's been doing lately, which is basically confusing the heck out of all of us.
Yeah.
For instance, there are two measures of consumer confidence. One is done by a think tank called the Conference Board, and the other is done by the University of Michigan. Now, what they poll monthly on a national poll. It's not like the University of Michigan just looks at people in Michigan. They go all over the U.S., and they usually follow pretty similar patterns, but right now there's a huge divergence. The University of Michigan number is declining from a sideways pattern it's been in since about 2016, and the Conference Board has been rising and is basically near an all-time high. So who's right? I don't know. I mean, the consumer seems like they're in good shape, but if you listen to the University of Michigan, they're in not as in good a shape as they were 2 years ago. So I don't know.
I think if you factored out the media, you'd find out that people are pretty happy. The proof to me is in the pudding, as they say. And if you look at retail sales, they have been going gangbusters.
Great. I mean, some of the biggest numbers I've seen since I've been tracking it.
Not just big numbers, but big increases also.
Yeah,
the trend lines are good. All right, and here's another one. Let's talk about employment. How many jobs are open in this country?
Somewhere around 7 million.
Yeah, about 7.3. And how many people are getting laid off?
Not many. The weekly jobless
claims. This week's
numbers
jumped up to 215,000 for first-time unemployment. Actual number, that's seasonally adjusted, of course. The actual number is 175. For that week, which is week number 34 of the year, over the entire 21st century so far, that average is 275,000 for that week. This year, with the biggest population ever, it was 175. That's 100,000 less people than average lost their jobs last week. That's phenomenal. This is not an economy where people are likely to be cutting back on their spending. The only reason this yield curve inversion keeps coming up is because the investor preference for bonds over stocks is forcing the yield down, and the second they realize how stupid they're being, the whole thing's going to change.
But again, you don't want to use the this time will be different argument necessarily when you're talking about the inverted yield curve. It is a fairly good recession indicator. It is not an immediate recession indicator.
And it doesn't cause one.
No. It is just the market signaling that we could be headed towards one.
It is, and I think it's completely and utterly nuts at this point in time.
Well, but again, it's in somewhere in 2 to 5 years. So
yeah, well, that's coming anyway.
Yeah, I could make that case easily.
What we have had the past 12 years or so without a recession is a virtually unique period of time brought to you by the world's slowest recovery from one of the world's deepest recessions.
Mm-hmm.
That automatically makes the playing field a little bit different this time.
Well, okay. I hate that
I know,
phrase.
I do too. I can't figure out a better way to say it.
Yeah. Oh, if you look at worldwide, though, there are statistics that show that recessions worldwide are getting further and further apart in their mm-hmm. frequencies. So a lot of that has to do with the theory is that monetary policy and the Fed manipulating interest rates is able to prolong periods between recessions. So yeah, it's not crazy. I mean, Australia, I believe, is over 30 years without one. Yeah. So,
well, in my opinion, you've got the right conclusion with the wrong reason. And I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about the world. I think the Fed makes it worse every time they do anything.
You can easily make that argument too, but yeah. It's so hard to prove either direction. Because
the sooner we wipe it out and forget we ever had it, the better off the world will be.
But the fact is we have it, so any other, if you're trying to make the other argument, you can say that that's what would have happened, but we don't know.
As Rumsfeld said, you go to war with the army you've got.
Correct.
And that's exactly what we're faced with in the economic war. We have the Fed, like it or not. All right, how do you know if your client is nuts, if you're an advisor?
It's usually pretty obvious.
How do you know if you're a client that your advisor is nuts?
That might not be as obvious right away.
Here's an example of who might figure who out. I don't know what I'm trying to say. This is just a crazy, crazy article I pulled out of MarketWatch. And I read it and I shake my head and say, really? Really, people? It's a young couple, youngish couple. I would call them young. 47 and 46 years old, been married 25 years, both professionals, make a good income, have two kids. They bought a home for $84,000, put $50,000 into it, and it's valued at $185,000. They've invested their money, maxing out 401ks and IRAs. Okay, all that's good. They got $50,000 set aside for college education so far. Okay, fine, we're doing well, right? So the guy says, so far you may not think we have a problem, which I think sounds like a pretty good conclusion right now, but we do. I spend a lot of my waking hours worrying. In 2017, as we approach the million-dollar milestone, the realization that our retirement is only 9 years away when I turn 55 in 2027 really hit me. I will point out now that we amassed our savings on our own without an advisor. Well, if you want to know why you stay up at night, it's because you're an idiot.
How do you really feel?
I feel like he's an idiot.
Okay.
When we retire at age 55, okay, you can retire from your career at 55 if you want to. But don't think that on $1 million, you're going to go very far in a lifestyle. All right, there's more to this. He's anticipating having $2 million by then. Okay, so you got two professionals raising a family, putting kids in college. They got $50,000. $50,000 to pay for some college? Not very much. But what do they want to do when they retire? Work part-time, do something productive, make some part-time money, whatever? No. They want to travel. 4% of $2 million would give you an $80,000 annual income without touching the principal. And you're going to finish up college for your girls, and you're going to travel all the time and live on $80,000.
Good luck.
Maybe you're going to travel in a used Volkswagen driving around Florida.
I mean, so it's possible that you could do this in an RV if you sold your house. I could see that.
That's not mentioned in here.
No.
And the other thing they're worried about is leaving a legacy that lasts not for just their children, but subsequent generations.
Well, I think I have identified the source of the worry.
I know $1 million sounds like a lot of money, people. I give you that every day. $2 million sounds like almost twice as much.
Mm-hmm.
It's not enough to live a lifestyle of ease at an age like that.
No.
You can't even file for early Social Security until 62. Not only that, you will have foregone 7 to 11 years of your highest earning potential. That means your Social Security accounts will not be as big as they would have if you just figured out that working another few years is a good idea. Now, this advisor says, sure, you can do that. No problem. I disagree with that advisor. He says, for the legacy, maybe you should consider an irrevocable trust. An irrevocable trust.
I don't understand that at all.
You are retiring at 55 with $2 million, and you're going to shelter that in an irrevocable trust?
For what?
Can an irrevocable trust be revoked?
I don't believe it
can. I don't think so. Can you get your money out of it? No. When you put money in an irrevocable trust, you give up total control of that money. You might retain the income, but you are no longer in control of your own money. And then this writer, advisor, whatever, says, You should actually get a financial advisor, because the laws on this vary from state to state. And the tax exemption is $11.4 million, so why are you using an irrevocable trust to try to avoid estate taxes that you couldn't in your wildest dreams get closer to? This whole thing, if you do what we do for a living, you just shake your head. I'd kick these people out the door before they finish their story, and they should have kicked their advisor or interviewer out the door just the same. People, let's be reasonable. 4% of anything, take 25 times your wanted income. That's how much money you're going to need. And if you're going to travel on $80,000, you're a better man than I am. All right, we'll be back right after the break. Don't go anywhere. We've got all kinds of fun things coming up yet. How about a 401k plan for your house? How's that for cool? Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And the trivia question still sits out there. What percentage of gym memberships that are paid for every month go unused?
And if you want to call and guess on that, it's actually good for a $25, I believe it's a Bono's barbecue gift certificate. So,
nice. Yeah. We can all use that. All right. A little quick note before I get into the meat of the thing. IRS is cracking down on cryptocurrencies.
They have been for about a, I think I first heard about that a month ago.
Who told you this first, people?
I believe we issued a pretty good warning.
I think we did. What is the ostensible purpose of the cryptocurrency? What is the actual result of it? Think about that for a little bit. Good morning, Paul.
Percentage of gym memberships that go unused, is that correct? Is that the question?
That is exactly the question.
Okay. Now, the answer, would that be for men or for women? Because I suspect there are probably two different answers here, and that one is probably higher for women than it is for men.
Aggravate them and divide by two.
Well, you know what it is? I give gift cards to my sister or other women, and 3 months later, they still haven't used them.
It's better than paying for them and not using them.
I did see it.
I'll give you a combined men and women answer, and I'm going to say 32%.
Too low.
Really?
Yeah. Can you imagine the cash flow these gyms have on unused memberships?
So...
I heard one figure one time of the cash total of unused gift cards, and it was a staggering figure. Something like almost $1 billion.
I believe it.
I would guess it might be even higher than that.
And it used to be they'd expire, so they were taking that as revenue. But now they don't expire, which I think is one of the better laws ever passed.
So this is funny. One statistic about men and women and how they use gyms or don't use gyms. 80% of gym members that join in January quit within 5 months, and that statistic is actually higher for women than it is for men.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's counterintuitive, isn't it?
Yeah, I was surprised.
Huh. Well, 32 is low, and it's low enough that it's outside the margin of error. So,
I guess I won't be getting that gift card that you're offering for Sonny's there, but thank
we'll,
you anyway.
We'll see you next week.
Yeah, you can always try again.
Okay, take care. Thanks for the call.
And the point of this is that there's so much money that we waste every year that we don't even realize.
Yeah.
And subscription-based services, I think, are the number one money waster out there. And gyms are a pretty big cost, too. Yeah, so the average person pays almost $60 a month.
I was thinking on the way out here today about this question, because Adam had posed it to me yesterday. And I got thinking, you know, that is actually probably helping their health by paying that money and not using it, because otherwise they'd be spending it on junk food. Now, is that a convoluted way of looking at things,
although,
or what?
Although I can make a counterpoint to that, it could be hurting them because the stress of knowing you should go to the gym that you're paying for and not going could be offsetting any benefit they might get.
Yeah, good point.
So...
All right. So your cryptocurrencies have all kinds of platitudes put to, with their use. It's mostly about being confidential and that kind of thing. But what do they really mean? I think what most people, or at least many people who are using the cryptos, are getting at is hiding transactions from the Internal Revenue Service. Now, people will probably deny that to your face and to my face, but IRS doesn't see it that way. They're seeing a lot of things going on that they can't account for. Now, that can be state and federal, because sales taxes aren't being paid on a lot of this stuff, and the capital gains and so on are not being paid on a bunch of the stuff that's crypto. And guess what? They're coming after you.
They're going to find you.
They are going to find you. They're working on it right now, and when they put their best people on it, I don't care how cryptified your crypto is, they're going to find you.
Mm-hmm.
If you have done things in the past and skirted taxes on them, I would suggest maybe fessing up. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Our pleasure. Thanks for calling. What's happening?
I have a young man who is a professional athlete who plays sports overseas.
Okay.
His income is probably going to be in six figures
mm-hmm.
annually. What professionals does he need to engage? And we're talking about a person here who doesn't have a family background of affluency, making money, managing money. What different professionals would he most likely need to engage so that he makes very good decisions regarding his life and his money?
What a great question.
Yeah.
I would say, first and foremost, this person would be very well served to hopefully just take an interest in his own money and his future. And any sort of mentor that could help out with that would be so valuable, because it sounds like he's in a pretty unique situation where he's going to have a high salary at a young age, where most people start off making very little money. And so they're learning about the budgeting process by the fact that they don't have any other options. But when you have expendable cash or your free cash flow at an early age, you really need to learn what to do with it. So engaging a financial professional like someone like us that does what we do, a fee-only fiduciary financial planner, he's got such a great opportunity to set himself up for life. That is an absolute must. On top of that, I would get an accountant that he can trust, because he is going to have some interesting tax situations being working overseas.
It's got to be somebody very well-versed in overseas, the expats, basically.
Right. And then on top of that, I think that you don't need a full-time lawyer or anything like that, but I would engage a lawyer to do some estate planning, set up a trust, and that the CFP, the financial advisor, can definitely help with that. Is there anything else you would recommend?
No, and I would do it in that order, because the purpose of the CFP is to be the home base for all of this stuff, working with the client, with the CPA, and with the attorneys and that sort of thing. But it all funnels right through, because where's the money? It will be under control of the CFP at a third-party custodian that everybody knows and trusts.
Yeah, just make sure that when he writes his first check for his own savings, that it goes to it doesn't go to a person. It goes to a financial institution like TD Ameritrade or Charles Schwab. You just, anytime you write a check to someone that says they're going to invest on your behalf, you are basically throwing away your money.
And remember that within 5 years of retirement, most professional athletes are somewhere between dead, broken, and deep trouble.
Right.
And you, when you're trying to condense a career earning into a period of 3 to 12 years or so, you have to understand that you can't spend it all. And I've got stories. I keep a stack of papers that I bring here every week, 2 or 3 inches thick. And probably half an inch of that is stories of athletes that got ripped off by their advisors.
No doubt about it.
Overspent their money. And in fact, I've got one. I'll go through one when I get done with the next piece and describe just how bad it is. People with stars in their eyes, they see a young athlete with a six-figure income, and all they can think about is ka-ching. And I don't mean for him, I mean for them. That, right. They give us, as advisors, they give us a black eye.
Yeah, but as important as the advisor would be, just someone who can, if he could find someone who's been in his position that would serve as sort of a mentor, that would be invaluable as well, because just the day-to-day lessons that could be imparted on a young athlete like that would be extremely valuable.
One of the stories I've got in my stack here is about a young guy who was a professional athlete and wound up getting a lot of bad advice and doing stupid things, and he got even. He became a financial advisor. Now, nice. He works with people like this. And if you want to know... Pardon me?
A football player?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You probably see the same one. All right, the music is playing, meaning we got to go, but if you want to know anything more... You can definitely call us at the office. You can look up VanWeFinancial.com, get our number or email or anything. But before you run, you want to take a shot at the trivia question?
Oh, I'll say 63%.
What was that?
63%.
63. Oh, you're just outside.
You are close,
so close.
But low. But great guess. Thank you very much. And if you can use anything further, please just let us know. We'd be happy to talk to you. All right, don't go away. We'll be right back. This is the VanWee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the VanWee Financial Hour. I'm Steve VanWee.
And I'm Adam VanWee.
And this segment brought to you by Robinson Landscape and Maintenance. Call Troy at 662-9794. All right, Adam has a little something he wants to get into for a couple minutes, and then I got a couple other topics to touch on. And my goodness, time goes fast. Fast when you're having fun.
No doubt about it. And also the trivia question is still out there. Mm-hmm. What percentage of gym memberships go unused every year? And we know it's between 63% and 80%, so really narrowed it down there.
Yep.
We live in Florida. In Florida, there's a lot of snowbirds, people that have sort of residence in New York, but just because there are a lot of New Yorkers here, but it could be really anywhere else.
Percentage-wise, you got a bunch of them.
Yeah, and then people have residences in Florida, and a lot of people do it because Florida is such a great place and also for tax reasons, but we actually have a caller.
Good morning, Leroy.
Good morning, sir.
Well, you want to take a shot?
Yeah, wild shot, 66.
You are the big winner. The actual number is 67, mm-hmm. and we were taking it plus or minus 2, so you hit it.
Yeah, and that turns out to be...
The previous caller.
Yeah, Alan helped you out a lot. Yeah. But
a whole bunch.
That actually comes out to be $1.8 billion of money that is spent but not used every year.
Yep, pretty much unearned income.
Crazy.
Amazing, isn't it?
Well, people get hawked into buying yearly memberships, and they should buy monthly, and they retire quickly, and they haven't lost much money.
Or that's absolutely true.
Pay per use is probably a better model for most people.
Absolutely. Yep. All right, we got your address. We'll ship it out to you. Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too.
All right, so as I was saying, Florida has a bunch of snowbirds. Mm-hmm. They come down here for the winter because of the weather, and they actually end up... homesteading here because the tax situation in Florida is so much better than so many other states. And the problem is the IRS is aware of that people do this and also wants to make sure that you're not spending more time in your other home state and claiming residency in Florida. And you're supposed to manually track that. I would say maybe less than 0% of people actually do that. So now if you are especially in a high tax bracket where the state that you're coming from really wants to collect that tax revenue from you, you might need to actually prove to the IRS or to that state that you spent the majority of your time in Florida. So there's an app for your phone that does that for you now. And
there's an app for that.
Exactly. So it sounds like there's a little bit of a privacy issue here because it actually tracks where you are all of the time during the year or where your phone is anyway. But if you are in a situation where the tax difference makes a huge difference in your annual income, it might be worthwhile to pay the monthly fee. It's an app called Moneo. And because it automatically records where you are, and then you can use that as a defense to the IRS or to the state that will allow you to prove that you're a Florida resident. So
I like it.
Yeah.
IRS, when dealing with the IRS, there's the oldest saying in the book is, he with the most paper wins. Well, that's been modified a little bit for electronic records, but he with the best records wins. So I like this one.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
It is indeed. All right. Many of you might remember the name Lauren Williams, first female athlete to win a gold medal in both the summer and winter Olympic Games. Pretty cool. So she is now a certified financial planner, fee only, in Pittsburgh. So she was interviewed in Think Advisor not terribly long ago, and it caught my eye about this question especially was, why did you become a financial planner? Her answer, having a crappy financial advisor myself when I was a junior in college, I was offered a six-figure sponsorship deal with Nike. That's what prompted me to go pro. In track and field, the only way to become pro is through a sponsorship. There's no draft for track and field.
Mm-hmm.
So you took the lucrative deal. How did you handle all that money? At 20 years old, I had no idea what to do with a six-figure income, so I hired a financial advisor, a Series 7 commission-based advisor who was very much interested, investment-focused, but what I needed was financial literacy, except that I didn't know what questions to ask. Did he make money for you? No. In 07, he gave me a call that I had lost money and on. She eventually transferred to a new one. And this guy, she said, he basically transferred all my accounts to his name and did nothing, and the accounts went down. So when you retired from pro sports, you started to explore financial planning. And said, yeah, I started to self-educate. I went back to school. I learned about the CFP program and NAPFA, the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, of which we are also members. And then I got hired as an intern, learned the business, and started my own. And that's how you get even.
Yeah, that's a really good way to do it. But you see the problem there. She didn't take enough of an interest in her own money.
Exactly.
To find out what separates a bad advisor from a good advisor. And that was the problem.
That was an expensive lesson that she learned.
Exactly.
And I'm hoping the young man that was discussed earlier on the show learns that before having some bad experience.
Really, it's unusual that the decisions you make with your money in your 20s affect the rest of your life, but for a professional
athlete...
More than
any other decisions you make because of the compounding factor.
Yep. For a professional athlete, that is exactly the situation that many of them find themselves in, and it can really make a difference in how the rest of your life goes.
Compounding is a great gift to mankind. The only problem with it is it takes a long time, and if you get started in your 20s, you got a long time.
Yeah, but if you're, you know, like the rest of us and you get hired in your 20s for somewhere between $20,000 and $50,000 a year and you're trying to make ends meet, really not going to make that much of a difference.
No. All right, what do I call a 401k for your home? There's a new mortgage out that is based on the theory that your loan might not reflect your house when you're done working on your house. It's called a 203K loan, and what it does is it gives you money on your basic loan to do two things, purchase a house and renovate it at the same time. This is new. I remember back in the old days, in the 70s, when we were all buying houses back in Wisconsin, we had a classic example with a good friend who had bought a beautiful old home on Lake Michigan and wanted to renovate the kitchen because it was pretty much in need of renovation. So he went to the bank and said, I need to remortgage the house to fill in this $20,000 or $30,000 or whatever he was putting into the kitchen. And they said, okay, as soon as it's done, call us, and then we'll get it appraised and give you the money. And he said, well, I need the money to do it. And this was the proverbial catch-22 that we all faced when we were dealing with these beautiful old homes and trying to fix them up, as the mortgage money would only be available once we were done, and we were already cash flowed out, being young and just getting started. Well, the 203K takes care of that. They look at what the place is now, and they look at what you're going to do to it. And they put their own internal controls on it such that the money gets allocated just like a construction loan would on a new purchase. It gets allocated as things get done going toward what you're eventually going to have as your finished product. So there are a lot of neighborhoods now that, as we all know, we drive through them all the time, they're very, very badly in need of renovation, and there's a lot of young people out there who don't have the cash built up to do the buying. When you've got the interest, when you've got the chutzpah, you want to really do this, and there's only one thing standing in your way, and that's the inability to mortgage the house of your dreams before it becomes the house of your dreams, this has squarely fit into that little slot. Now, it's not only for purchase. If you're living in one and it's tired and run down and you would really like to renovate, you can also approach people about doing this. And when you get contractors and bankers together, basically, or mortgage people back, and they look at what the product that you're going to have is, and they mortgage it in. And you can get them at fixed rates now, that sort of thing. But it combines all of your needs, whether it's purchase or just improvement. And, by the way, if you want to put an addition on an existing house, you can actually incorporate that into the 203K also. It has a very low down payment requirement of only 3.5%. And it's available to anyone. You do not have to be a first-time home buyer to get this. Up to 6 months' payments can be financed if you're renovating, but you have to move out during the renovation. The total amount of the loan is limited to 96.5% of the post-renovation value. And it will do all of this if you get the right mortgage person. Not everybody does 203Ks. So
in fact,
if you're looking
you have
one,
to look around to find
you do have
person.
To look around very much. And we do have personal experience within our family using these, and it is an absolute miraculous thing that should have been thought of a long time ago. I guess we all sort of thought of it. We just didn't get around to actually figuring out how to do it. So, quick note, there's an economist named Zandi, Mark Zandi, that I've followed for ever and ever and have laughed at him for just that long. He says now that Trump is the biggest risk to the U.S. economy. Stupidity is everywhere. You don't have to pay for it. We'll see you next week. This has been a lot of fun. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour.